This town to us was called Atinai, a total shitscape. Only good thing that came of it was Z. Celine scans Genek's lithe frame quizzical. Are you feeling all right?
Oh yes, fine. Just my stomach is all. Atinai ruined me.
Goddamn Soviets. Doc thinks it's an ulcer.
I've been treating quite a few of those. If you're not better soon, let me know. I'll see what I can do to help.
Thanks.
A patient calls from across the room, and Selly motions with his clipboard.
I'd better get going.
Genek nods.
Of course.
But as Selim turns, something occurs to Genek, and he reaches for his brother-in-law's shoulder again.
Wait, Selim, before you go, he says.
I've been thinking I should start writing to the Red Cross, now that I'm traceable through the army.
Genek's friend Otto had just been able to connect with his brother this way, and Genek couldn't help but wonder whether he might have similar luck.
Perhaps we could go together, fill out some forms, send some telegrams.
Selim nods.
It's worth a try, he offers.
They make a plan to meet in a few days at the Red Cross office in Tel Aviv. Selim tucks his clipboard under his arm and turns once again to go.
Selim, Genek says, allowing a smile to stretch across his cheeks.
It's really great to see you.
Selim returns the smile.
You too, Genek. I'll see you on Sunday. I'm looking forward to meeting your son.
Genek shakes his head as he makes his way back to his cot.
Selim, in Palestine of all places. It's a good sign. It has to be.
He won't limit his Red Cross search to Poland, Genek decides. He'll send telegrams to Red Cross offices all over Europe, to the Middle East, and to the Americas. Surely, if the others are alive, they'll have been in touch with the location services as well. He climbs back onto his cot and lies down, resting one hand on his heart, the other on his stomach, where, for the moment, the pain has subsided.
April 19th to May 16th, 1943. Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. In liquidating the Warsaw Ghetto, Hitler deports and exterminates some 300,000 Jews. The 50,000 who remain secretly plan an armed retaliation. The uprising begins on the eve of Passover, at the outset of a final liquidation operation. Ghetto residents refuse to be taken, and fight off the Germans for nearly a month, until defeated by the Nazis' systematic destruction and burning of the ghetto. Thousands of Jews die in combat and are burned alive or suffocated. Those who survive the uprising are sent to Treblinka and other extermination camps. September 1943. Anders's men stationed in Tel Aviv are mobilized and sent to Europe to fight on the Italian front. Wives and children stay behind in Tel Aviv.
Chapter 44. Halina. Warsaw, German-occupied Poland, October 1943.
Sit, the officer hisses, pointing to a metal chair opposite his desk in the small railway police office.
Halina presses her lips together into an angry line. She's more confident when she stands.
I said sit.
Halina obeys. Seated, she's eye to barrel with a pistol holstered to the German's belt. It's only a matter of time, she realizes, before her luck runs out. Leaving her apartment in Warsaw Center that morning, she'd kissed Adam goodbye and reminded him she wouldn't be returning until late. Her plan was to make her way to the train station after work, ride to Villanuf, then walk the 4 kilometers from the station to the Gursky's home in the country, where she would see her parents and deliver the Gursky's their payment for the month of October. She'd stay for an hour and then return to Warsaw. She's made the trip to Villanuf 3 times already, and until now, her false papers required to purchase tickets and to board and disembark the train have worked flawlessly. Today, though, she'd barely made it through ticketing at the Warsaw station. She was waiting by the tracks when a member of the Gestapo, Hitler's secret police, approached her, demanding her papers.
Why do you need to see them? She asked in Polish. She's fluent now in German, but the Gestapo, she's learned, are suspicious of German-speaking Poles.
Routine check, he'd replied.
He studied her ID and quizzed her on her name and birthdate.
Brzoza,
Halina had recited with conviction. April 17th, 1917. But the officer shook his head as the train approached.
You're coming with me, he said, leading Halina by the arm through the station. Who do you work for?
The officer wants to know. He remained standing. Halina met her new employer, Herr Den, only 2 weeks earlier. He'd attended a dinner party at the home of her previous boss, where she worked as a maid and kitchen helper. Den is Austrian, a successful banker in his 60s. Halina recalls the night she first served him dinner, how he'd watched her closely as she worked. Apparently he was impressed, which was no surprise. Halina had grown up in a home with a cook and a maid. She had an appreciation for good service. Later that same night, Den had surprised her. She was at the kitchen sink when he approached. She didn't realize he was even in the room until he was beside her.
Chopin?
He'd asked, catching her off guard. Excuse me, she'd said.
The melody you were just humming, was it Chopin?
Halina hadn't even realized she was humming. Yes, she'd nodded. I suppose it was. Den had smiled. You have lovely taste in music, he said, before turning to go. The next day, she received notice from her placement agency that she would begin working for Den the following week. Whether or not he suspects she is Jewish, Halina has no idea. So far, he seems to like her.
I work for Herr Gerhard Den,
Halina says, sighing as if put off by the question.
What is his occupation?
Head of the Austrian bank in Warsaw.
What sort of work do you do?
I am his housemaid.
What is his telephone?
Halina recites the bank's phone number from memory and waits as the officer dials. Damn these routine checks. Damn the Gestapo. Damn the Poles who are constantly taking it upon themselves to tip off the Germans, rat out the Jews. For what? A kilo of sugar? Friendship means nothing anymore. She knew it in Radom, the day her school friend Sylvia refused to acknowledge her when she passed by on her way to the beet farm. And she was reminded of it often here in Warsaw, where she's been accused on several occasions of being Jewish. It wasn't just the suspicious landlady. There was the friend of her old boss, a German woman who followed her down the street one day and whispered a spiteful,
I know your secret,
as she came shoulder to shoulder with Halina on the sidewalk. Without thinking, Halina had pulled her into an alleyway, stuffed a week's worth of pay into her palm, and told her through clenched teeth to keep her mouth shut. This before she realized it was safer never to confess to anyone. Shortly after, worried that if she didn't keep bribing her, the woman might reveal her identity to her boss, she found a new job. There was also their Wehrmacht soldier, who recognized Halina from Lvov, from before she'd taken on her new name. She'd opted for a softer approach to feeling him out, and invited him for an espresso at a Nazi-run cafe on Piekna Street. She turned up the charm as she chatted for a full hour, at the end of which the soldier seemed more smitten than curious about her previous life. She left him with a kiss on a cheek and an intuitive feeling that even if he did remember her true identity, he'd keep it under wraps. Of course, there was nothing she could do about the Poles she overheard on Chłodna Street the day in May, when the SS finally razed the city ghetto and liquidated the last of its inhabitants in a last-ditch effort to quell an uprising.
Hey, look, the Jews are burning, one of the Poles had said when Halina passed. They had it coming, another professed.
It was all Halina could do not to seize the men by the lapels and shake them. She'd nearly forfeited her Aryan identity that day, to fight alongside the Jews in the uprising, to play a part, no matter how doomed the effort was, in standing up to the Germans. She'd reminded herself at the time that she had her parents to think of, her sister. She had to keep herself safe in order to keep her family safe. And so she'd watched from afar as the ghetto burned, her heart filled with sorrow and hatred, but also with pride. Never before had she witnessed such a valiant act of self-defense. The officer holds the receiver to his ear and glares at her. She returns the glare, defiant, outraged. After a minute, someone at the other end answers.
"I wish to speak with the Herr Dent, please," the officer says.
There is a long pause, then another voice at the other end of the line.
"Herr Dent, I apologize for bothering you. I have someone here at the station who claims to work for you, and I have reason to believe she is not who she says she is."
Silence. Helena holds her breath. She focuses on her posture. Shoulders down, back straight, knees and feet pressed tightly together.
"She claims her name is Brzoza. B-R-Z-O-Z-A.
The line is quiet. Has Den hung up? What's her backup plan? She hears a murmur, her boss's voice, but she can't make out the words. Whatever he's saying, his tone is angry. The reception must be poor because the officer slows his speech to enunciate every word.
"Her papers state she is a Christian."
Den is talking again, louder now. The officer holds the phone a fist width from his ear, scowling, until the barking ceases. Helena catches a few words.
"Shamed. Certain. Myself." "You are sure? All right. All right, no, don't come in. That won't be necessary. Yes, I understand. We will, sir, right away. I apologize again for bothering you."
The officer slams the phone into its base. Helena exhales. Standing, she thrusts a palm over the desk.
"My papers," she says with disgust.
The officer frowns as he slides her ID across the table. Helena snatches it up.
"Outrageous," she spits softly,
just loud enough for the officer to hear, before turning to leave.
January to March 1944. The Allies, in an effort to secure a route to Rome, begin a series of unsuccessful attacks on the German stronghold of Monte Cassino, located in the Lazio region of central Italy.
Chapter 45. Genek. River Sangro, central Italy. April 1944.
"This better be good," Otto says, leaning back in his chair, crossing his arms over his chest.
Genek nods, suppressing the urge to yawn. Between the persistent lull of rain and the pigra hufka filling his stomach, this particular batch was so heavy his spoon had stuck straight up in the bowl, like a flagpole. He's nearing a comatose state. At the front of the mess tent, the commanding officer, Pavlik, climbs onto a meter-high wooden platform, a podium of sorts, from which he delivers his speeches. His expression is serious.
"Looks like he means business tonight," Genek remarks,
as conversation beneath the tent fades and eyes turn toward the square-shouldered captain standing before them.
"You said that last time, and the time before that," Otto huffs, shaking his head.
Genek and Otto, along with the rest of Anders' 40,000-odd recruits, have been holed up for the month of April on the banks of Italy's River Sangro. Their position, as Pavlik showed them on the map when they arrived, is strategic. A 2-day trek from Monte Cassino, a German stronghold 120 kilometers southeast of Rome. The Cassino is a 1,400-year-old rock-walled monastery, towering 520 meters above sea level. But more important, it's the hub of the Nazis' line of defense. The Germans occupying it are using it as a vantage point to spot and shoot down anyone who approaches. Allied forces have made 3 separate attempts on it. So far, it's proved impregnable. "Maybe tonight's news will be different," Genek offers. Otto rolls his eyes. Despite Otto's complaining, Genek is grateful to have his friend by his side. He's been the one constant since they left Hertha, Yusef, and Otto's wife Yulia behind in Tel Aviv to travel with the army through Egypt and across the Mediterranean by British ship to Italy. They'd only ever fired practice shots from their Tommy guns, of course, but the men understood without actually verbalizing it that when the orders finally came and they found themselves aiming at real targets, they'd look out for each other and for one another's families should anything happen to either of them in the field.
Gentlemen, Pavlik calls.
The men of the Polish Army's 1st Survey Brigade sit at attention.
Listen up. I have news. Orders. Finally, what we've all been waiting for.
Otto's eyebrows jump. He glances at Genek. You were right, he mouths and smiles. Genek uncrosses his legs, leans forward in his chair, his senses suddenly heightened. Pavlik clears his throat.
Allied forces and President Roosevelt have met to discuss a 4th massive offensive on Monte Cassino, he begins. The first phase of the plan, codename Operation Diadem, calls for large-scale deception targeted at Field Marshal Kesselring. The goal? To convince Kesselring that the Allies have abandoned further attacks on Monastery Hill and that our mission is now to land at Civitavecchia.
Genek and Otto have been briefed in detail about the 3 previous attacks on Monte Cassino, each a bitter, bloody failure. The first came in January, when the British and the French attempted to flank the monastery from the west and the east respectively, while the French Expeditionary Corps fought in ice and snow against the Germans of the 5th Mountain Division in the north. But the Brits and the French met heavy mortar fire, and the frostbitten fighters in the Expeditionary Corps, though close to victory, were finally outnumbered. A second attempt came in February, when hundreds of Allied fighter planes dropped round after round of 450-kilo bombs on Cassino, reducing the monastery to rubble. The New Zealand Corps was set to occupy the ruins, but the steep terrain leading up to it was impossible to maneuver, and German parachuters reached the now roofless monument first. A month later, in a 3rd Allied attempt on Monte Cassino, the New Zealand Corps dropped 1,250 tons of explosives over Cassino, flattening the town and stretching the German defense to a breaking point. A division of Indian troops came close to securing the monastery, but after 9 days of being pommeled by mortar bombs, Nebelwerfer rockets and smoke shells, the Allies were once again forced to retreat. Genek runs the numbers in his mind. 3 failed attempts. Thousands of casualties. What makes their commanding officer believe that a 4th attempt will be successful?
Diversionary tactics, Pavlik shouts, include cold messages meant to be intercepted by German intelligence and Allied troops dispatched to Salerno and Naples to be seen practicing.
He rabbit-ears his fingers around the word
amphibious landings. They also include Allied air forces making conspicuous reconnaissance flights over the beaches at Civitavecchia and false information fed to German spies. These tactics are key to the success of the mission.
Pavlik's men nod, collectively holding their breath as they await the news that matters most, their orders. Pavlik clears his throat. Rain patters on the waxed canvas overhead.
In this 4th attempt on Monte Cassino, Pavlik says, his voice lower than before, 13 divisions have been assigned orders, with the goal of securing Cassino's perimeter. The U.S. 2nd Corps will attack from the west up the coast along the line of Route 7 toward Rome. The French Expeditionary Corps will attempt to scale the Arunchi Mountains to the east. In between, the British 13th Corps will attack along the Liri Valley. Anders' army, however, has been assigned what I believe to be the most critical task of the mission.
He pauses, looks around at his men. They are silent, listening intently, their spines rifle barrel straight, jaws locked. Pavlik enunciates each of his words carefully.
Gentlemen, we, the men of the Polish 2nd Corps, have been charged with the task of capturing Monastery Hill.
The words hit Genek like a punch to the esophagus, leaving him breathless.
We will attempt what the 4th Indian Division in February failed to do, to isolate the monastery and push around behind it into the Liri Valley.
There, we will link with 13th Corps. Canadian 1st Corps will be held in reserve to exploit the breakthrough. If we are successful, Pavlik adds, we will penetrate the Gustav Line and pinch out the position of the German 10th Army. We'll open up the road to Rome. A murmur fills the tent as the recruits process the momentousness of their mission. Genick and Otto look at one another. I have complete faith in this army, Pavlik continues, nodding. This is Anders' moment in history. This is Poland's moment to shine. Together, we will make our country proud. He raises his first two fingers to his cap, and the tent erupts as men leap from their chairs, cheering, pumping their fists, saluting, yelling. This is our time, our moment to shine. God save Poland, they shout. Genick follows suit and stands. Although he can't bring himself to partake in the revelry, his knees are soft and his stomach churns, threatening to disgorge his dinner. As the men settle back into their seats, Pavlik explains that the French Expeditionary Corps has already begun secretly constructing camouflaged bridges over the River Rapido, which Anders' army will need to cross in order to reach the monastery. So far, the bridges have gone unnoticed, he explains. As soon as the last is complete, we'll leave our position here and move east to a location along the Rapido. To maintain secrecy, we'll travel in small units by night, under strict radio silence. Pack your things, gentlemen, and prepare yourselves for battle. Our orders to move will come at any moment. Sitting cross-legged in his pup tent, Genick rolls his spare socks and undershirt into tight, damp bundles and stuffs them into the bottom of his pack. He adjusts his headlamp, Pavlik's words clattering about in his mind. It's happening. He's going to battle. How will the mission unfold? There's no telling, of course. And it's the unknown that scares him the most. Even more so than the thought of climbing up a 520-meter hill toward an army of Germans with weapons trained at him from behind a fortress of stone. What Genick does know is that the Poles are one of some 20 Allied divisions, among them American, Canadian, French, British, New Zealander, South African, Moroccan, Indian, and Algerian, positioned along the 30-kilometer stretch from Cassino to the Gulf of Gaeta. Why would the Allies assign the Poles of all armies what one might call the most daunting task of all? Why choose the men who have come not from elite training camps, but from labor camps? Men who required nearly a year of rest and recuperation in the Middle East before their leader deemed them fit enough to fight? It doesn't make any sense. For the world to have that much faith in Anders' army is an aberration as much as it is an honor. And then, of course, there's the notion Genick refuses to believe, that the ragtag group of Poles is so devoid of value, they're best put to use as cannon fodder on what is surely a suicide mission. No, Genick reminds himself, they have been chosen for a reason. They are Poles, and what they lack in preparedness, they will make up for in fervor. He slips a pair of woolen undergarments and gloves into his pack, along with a journal and his deck of cards. Eyeing a worn copy of Yashchensky's I Burn Paris beside his mat, he pulls a spare piece of army-issued letterhead from the inside cover and reaches to his breast pocket for a pen. Taking a break from packing, he lies on his side, setting the blank page on the book's cover. Dearest Hertha, he writes, and then pauses. He'd feel better if he could tell her about his mission. His first, to capture the Cassino, the linchpin of German defense. He tries to picture himself in battle, but the image feels surreal, like a scene out of a film. Would she be impressed to learn of his orders, to know he was about to be part of something so noble, so monumental, or at least something that had the potential to be monumental? Or would she be terrified, as he is,
by the enormity of the task at hand, by the prospect of finding himself in the wrong place at the wrong time? She would be terrified, Genek knows. She would beg him to be safe. But Herta will never know, Genek reminds himself. He's been forbidden to put anything to paper that would, if intercepted, offer a clue of their plan. So instead, he writes, "How is Tel Aviv? Sunny, I hope. We are here still on Italian soil. The rain is relentless. My tent, my clothes, everything is perpetually damp. I can't remember what it feels like to pull on a dry shirt. Without much to do but take cover and wait, I've spent hours playing cards and reading and rereading the handful of books passed around. Strug, Yashinsky, Stern, what? There's a work of poetry by Leshmian which you would enjoy, called Forest Happenings. You might look for a copy." Genek listens to the drum of raindrops on the A-frame of his tent, thinking of the weekend in the mountains when he first laid eyes on Herta. He pictures himself in his white cable-knit sweater and English tweed pants, Herta close by his side in her smart goose-down ski jacket, her cheeks pink from the cold, her hair freshly washed and smelling of lavender. How surreal it felt now, looking back on it, as if he'd dreamt it. "Despite the rain," he continues, "morale here is surprisingly high. Even Wojtek seems to be in good spirits, lumbering happily around camp in search of handouts. You should see how big he's grown." Private Wojtek, the only official four-legged member of Anders' army, is a bear. He was discovered in Iran as an orphaned cub. Wojtek, Polish for smiling warrior, is now the unofficial mascot for the Polish Second Corps. He's traveled with the army from Iran, through Iraq, Syria, Palestine, and Egypt, and finally to Italy. Along the way, he's learned to haul ammunition and to salute when greeted. He enjoys a good boxing match, and he nods in approval when rewarded with a bottle of beer or a cigarette, both of which he eagerly devours. Understandably so, Wojtek is easily the most popular member of the Polish Second Corps. Genek rolls onto his stomach, reads what he's written. Will his wife see through it? Herta knows him well enough to sense when he's hiding something. He flips to the back of I Burn Paris and retrieves a photo. In it, Herta, perched on a low stone wall in Tel Aviv, wears a new gray collared dress. He's standing beside her in his army attire. He remembers when Otto took the photo. Yulia had held Yosef while Otto counted to three, and just before he snapped the picture, Herta had looped her arm through Genek's, leaned into him, and flipped her toe playfully like a schoolgirl on a date. He misses her. More than he knew was humanly possible. Yosef, too. "I'm not sure when I'll be able to write next. We'll be restationed soon. I'll be in touch as soon as I can. Please don't worry." Of course Herta will worry, Genek thinks, regretting his word choice. He's worried. Petrified. He chews on the end of his pen. Three failures. An army of ex-prisoners. The odds aren't in the Polish Second Corps' favor. "How are you?" he concludes. "How is Z?" "Reply soon. I love you and miss you more than you can imagine. Yours, Genek." Chapter 46. Addie. Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. April 1944. On the night Addie returned from Minas Gerais, he and Eliska ended their engagement. They weren't meant to be married, they agreed. It wasn't easy. Neither of them wanted to be alone, nor did they want to be seen as people who would voluntarily give up, even though they both knew that giving up, in this case, was for the best. They would remain friends, they said. And as hard as it was, Addie felt 1,000 kilos lighter on his feet once the decision was made. Madame Lofbier, of course, was thrilled to learn that the engagement had been called off, and shortly after, in an ironic twist, she took a new liking to Addie. Apparently, with the prospect of having him as a son-in-law officially erased, the Grand Dame was capable of socializing with a Pole. She'd begun inviting Addie to her apartment on the weekends to play the piano and requesting his handyman help when her radio malfunctioned. She'd even offered to put him in touch with a contact at General Electric in the States, should he ever decide to emigrate north. Addie spent the months following the breakup focusing on his work, on his weekly trips to the post office, and on the radio broadcasts and periodicals that brought him news of the war. None of it was encouraging. The constant battle in Anzio and Monte Cassino, Italy, the bombs dropped in the South Pacific and over Germany. Addie was sickened by all of it. The only auspicious bit of information he'd stumbled across was that of American President Franklin Roosevelt issuing an executive order to create a war refugee board, which would be responsible for rescuing victims of enemy oppression in imminent danger of death, as the article phrased it. At least someone somewhere was helping, Addie thought, wondering what the chances were of his parents, brothers, and sisters being among the rescued. Addie's spirits were particularly low when his friend Jonathan knocked on the door to his apartment in Copacabana. "I'm throwing a party next weekend," Jonathan said in his smart British accent. "You're coming. If I recall, your birthday is right around the corner. You've been hibernating long enough." Addie waved his hand in protest, but before he could decline the invitation, Jonathan added, "I've invited the embassy girls," flashing a smile that said, "You could use a date, brother." Addie had heard plenty about the American embassy girls. Amid Rio's small circle of expats, they were rather famous for their good looks and adventurous spirits, but he'd never met any of them.
"I mean it. You should come," Jonathan pressed. "Just for a drink. It'll be fun."
On Saturday evening, Addie stands in the corner of Jonathan's Ipanema flat, nursing a cachaça and water, slipping in and out of conversation. He's distracted by thoughts of home. In 2 days, he will turn 31. Halina, wherever she is, will be 27. It will have been 6 years since they celebrated together. Addie recalls how, for that last birthday, his 25th, he and Halina had spent the evening at one of Rytham's new clubs, where they drank too much champagne and danced until their feet hurt. He sifted through the details of the night 1,000 times, rolling them over in his mind to keep him sharp. The tangy aftertaste of the lemon chiffon cake they'd shared, the way his sister's hands had felt in his as they danced, the thrilling pop of their second bottle of Ruinar being uncorked, how the bubbles had burned his throat, and a few sips later, made his tongue go numb. Pesach had been the night before. The family had celebrated in the usual boisterous fashion, gathered first at the dining table, and then around the piano in the living room on Warszawska Street. Addie swirls his drink, watching a single ice cube orbit the glass, wondering if Halina is somewhere thinking about him too. When he looks up, his eyes are drawn to a figure across the room, a brunette. She stands by the window with a wine glass in hand, listening to a friend, a single point of calm amid the cacophony. An embassy girl? Must be. Suddenly, everyone else in the room is invisible. Addie studies the young woman's tall, slender frame, the graceful slope of her cheekbones, her easy smile. She wears a pale green cotton halter dress that buttons down the front and ties at the waist, a watch with a simple band, brown leather sandals with thin straps that wrap loosely around the fine bones of her ankles. Her eyes are soft, her expression open, as if she has nothing to hide. She is beautiful, strikingly so, but in an unassuming way. Even from afar, he can sense her modesty. "What the hell," he decides. Maybe Jonathan was right. With a disconcerting jitter in his gut, Addie sets his glass down and makes his way across the room. As he approaches, the girl turns. He offers her his hand.
Addy, he says, and then in the same breath, please excuse my English. The brunette smiles. Pleasure to meet you, she says, taking his hand. Addy was right. She is definitely American. I'm Caroline. Don't apologize. Your English is lovely. She speaks slowly, and the way she pronounces her words, soft and round, so he can't quite tell where one ends and the next begins, makes Addy feel at home beside her. This woman, Addy realizes, emanates an air of acceptance and ease. She is perfectly content, it seems, to simply be. Something stirs in Addie's heart as he realizes he was once that way. Caroline is patient with Addie's broken English. When he stumbles over a word, she waits for him to gather his thoughts, to try again. And Addy is reminded that it's okay to slow down, to take his time. When he asks where in the States she is from, she tells him about the town in South Carolina where she was born. I loved growing up there, Caroline says. Clinton was a close-knit community, and we were always very involved with the schools and the church. But I think I always knew I wouldn't stay. I had to get out. It started to feel so small. My poor mother. Caroline sighs, describing her mother's shock upon hearing that she and her best friend, Virginia, had made plans to travel to South America. She thought we were crazy to up and leave our lives in South Carolina. Addy nods, smiling. You are, how do you say, you have no fear. I suppose you could say we were brave for coming here. I think, though, we were just after an adventure. My father leave his home in Poland, too, he says, for America, for adventure, when he was young man, no children. He always tell me how much I will love New York City. Why did he return? Caroline asks. For helping his mother, Addy says. After his father died, she cared for 5 children in the home, all alone. My father want to help. Caroline smiles. He sounds like a good man, your father. Their conversation ends when a friend Caroline introduces as Virginia, who goes by Gina, finally pulls her away. They are headed to another party, Gina says, winking a blue eye at Addy as she links elbows with Caroline. Addy watches the backs of the women's heads as they bob toward the door, wishing the conversation hadn't ended so quickly. He leaves shortly after, offering Jonathan a friendly slap on the back on his way out. Thank you, amigo, he says. I'm glad I came. He thinks of Caroline on his walk home, and nearly every minute for the next week. There was something about her that made him want badly to get to know her better. And so, after tracking down her address in Lemmy, he musters the courage to leave a note under her door, written with the help of a newly purchased French-English dictionary. Dear Caroline, I enjoyed to speak with you last weekend. If you would be so obliged, it would please me to take you to dine at the restaurant Belmont near Hotel Copacabana Palace. I proposition we meet at the palace for an aperitif at 8 o'clock this Saturday, April the 29th. I hope to see you there. Yours, Addy Kurtz. A few days later, wearing a freshly pressed shirt and carrying a purple orchid he'd picked up at a flower stand along the way, Addy arrives at the Copacabana Palace, the same flutter tickling at his insides that he'd felt when he and Caroline first met. He's checking the time. 8 o'clock to the minute when Caroline steps through the lobby's revolving glass door. She waves when she sees him, and in an instant, Addy forgets to be nervous. At the hotel bar, they talk about their days and the things they love about Rio. Addy's English has improved. Never before has he been so motivated to learn, but it is still rough. Caroline, though, doesn't seem to notice. The first time I ate a churrasqueria, she blushes, I ate myself sick. I felt so awful leaving any meat on the plate, so I'd force it down, and then they'd bring me more. Addy jokes about the excruciatingly slow pace at which the locals in Rio move, parading his first 2 fingers along the bar to demonstrate his cadence compared with that of a typical Brazilian.
No one here is in a hurry, he says, shaking his head.
Later on at Belmont, Caroline asks Addie to order for the two of them. As they converse, this time over bowls of moqueca de camarão, shrimp stewed in coconut milk, Addie learns that Caroline is one of four Martin siblings, and that her three older brothers, whose names he asks her to repeat again and again, Edward, Taylor, and Venable, still live at home in Clinton. We had a cow in our backyard when we were children, Caroline says, her eyes lighting up as she reminisces. Addie nearly chokes when she reveals that the cow's name was Sarah. His little sister Halina's Hebrew name, he explains. Caroline blushes. Oh, I hope I haven't offended you, she says. Sarah was part of the family, she adds. We'd milk her and sometimes even ride her to school. Addie smiles. It sounds like your Sarah was a lot less stubborn than mine. He goes on to tell Caroline about Halina, reminded of the time after seeing it happened one night, that she insisted on cutting her hair short to look like Claudette Colbert, and how she'd refused to leave the apartment for days after, convinced the look didn't suit her. Laughing, Addie realizes how good it feels to talk of his family, how hearing their names helps, in a way, to confirm their existence. Caroline tells him about her family as well, about her father, a mathematics professor at Presbyterian College in Clinton, who had taught right up until his death in 1935. We didn't grow up with many luxuries, she says, except for our schooling. You can imagine with a professor for a father how he felt about our education. Addie nods. His parents weren't professors, but receiving a good education was paramount in his household growing up, too. What did you call your father? Addie asks, curious. What was his name? Caroline smiles. His name was Abram. Addie looks at her. Abram? As similar to Abraham? Yes, Abram. Derived from Abraham. It's a family name. Passed down from my great-grandfather. Addie smiles and then reaches to his pocket for his mother's handkerchief, laying it flat on the table between them. My mother, she... He mimes the act of sewing with a needle and thread. She sews? Yes. She sews this for me before I leave Poland. Here, Addie points. These are my... How do you call them? Initials. These are my initials. The A is for my Hebrew name. Abraham. Caroline leans over the handkerchief, studying the embroidery. You are an Abraham too? Si. Our families have very good taste in names, Caroline says, smiling. Addie folds the handkerchief and slips it back into his pocket. Perhaps they are woven from the same thread, he decides. Caroline is quiet for a moment. She looks down at her lap. My mother passed away 3 years ago, she says. It's one of my biggest regrets, that I wasn't there when she died. It is a confession that surprises Addie, for he has just met Caroline. In the years that he was with Eliska, she hardly ever spoke of her past, let alone her regrets. He nods in understanding, thinking of his own mother and wishing he could say something to comfort her. Maybe Caroline would feel less alone knowing that he, too, missed his mother terribly. He hasn't told her, of course, about losing contact with his family. He'd grown so accustomed to avoiding the subject he wasn't even sure he could bring himself to talk about it. Where would he begin? He looks up, meeting Caroline's eyes. There is something so earnest about her, so gentle. You can talk to her, he realizes. Try. I know how it is you feel, he says. Caroline looks surprised. You've lost your mother too? Well, not exactly. I don't know, you see. My family, I think, is still in Poland. You think? Addie glances at his lap. I don't know for sure. We are Jews. Caroline reaches for his hand across the table, with tears in her eyes.
and all of a sudden, the story that he hasn't told for so many years comes tumbling out. 2 weeks later, Addie and Caroline sit at a desk pushed up against an east-facing window in Caroline's apartment overlooking Lemmy Beach, a stack of parchment before them. They've seen each other almost every day since their first dinner at Belmont. It was Caroline's idea to contact the Red Cross for help locating his family. Addie dictates, leaning over Caroline's arm as she writes. Her optimism has energized him, and the words spill from his lips faster than she can keep up. "Wait, wait, slow down," Caroline laughs. "Can you spell your mother's name for me again?" She looks up, the velvet brown of her irises catching in the light. Her fountain pen hovers over the paper. Addie clears his throat. The softness in her eyes, the soapy smell of her auburn hair, make him lose his train of thought. He spells Nehuma, trying not to butcher the English pronunciation of the letters, then his father's name and those of each of his siblings. Caroline's cursive, Addie notes, is effortless and elegant compared with his own. When the letter is complete, Caroline retrieves a slip of paper from her purse. "I asked at the embassy," she says, setting it between them and running her finger down a list of cities. "And it seems there are Red Crosses stationed everywhere. We should send your letter to several offices, just in case." Addie nods, scanning the 15 cities Caroline has compiled, ranging from Marseille, London, and Geneva, to Tel Aviv and Delhi. She's written an address next to each. They talk quietly as Caroline carefully pens 15 copies of Addie's letter. When she's finished, she gathers her stack of stationery and taps it gently on the table so the edges are neatly aligned, and then hands it to Addie. "Thank you," Addie says. "This is so very important for me," he adds, one hand over his heart, wishing he could better articulate how much her help means to him. Caroline nods. "I know. It's just awful what's going on over there. I hope you hear back. At least for the moment you'll know you've done everything you can." Her expression is sincere, her words comforting. He'd met her only a few weeks ago, but Addie has learned that there's no guessing when it comes to knowing what Caroline is thinking. She simply says what she means to say, without embellishment. He finds the trait refreshing. "You have a heart from gold," Addie says, realizing as the words leave him how cliched they sound, but he doesn't care. Caroline's fingers are long, narrow at the tips. She waves them in front of her face, shakes her head. She's not good, Addie's also learned, at receiving praise. "I bring to the post office tomorrow," he says. "You'll let me know the moment you hear something?" "Yes, of course." Through the window, Addie looks east over Lemmy Rock and the deep blue of the Atlantic toward Europe. "In time," he says, trying to sound hopeful. "In time, I will find them."
May 11, 1944. The fourth and final battle of Monte Cassino begins. As hoped, the Allies take German forces by complete surprise. As the French Expeditionary Corps destroys the southern hinge of German defenses, the 13th Corps, a formation of the British 8th Army, moves inland, capturing the town of Cassino and striking German forces in the Liri Valley. The Poles, in their first attempt to capture the Cassino, are repelled. Casualties approach 4,000 as two battalions are wiped out entirely. Under continued assaults, the monastery remains impregnable.
Chapter 47. Genek. Monte Cassino, Italy, May 17, 1944. Mortar rockets overhead. Genek cups the back of his helmet with his hands, his body pressed up against the face of the mountain. He's grown accustomed to the stabbing pain of his knees and elbows landing hard against the unforgiving rock, to the grit of dust between his teeth, to the constant clap and whir of artillery buzzing his ears at an exceedingly uncomfortable proximity. 400 meters above, what's left of the enemy, a regiment of what is thought to be 800 German paratroopers, fires round after round of shells from the ruins of the monastery. Genick can't help but wonder where all of their ammunition is coming from. Surely they'll run out soon. The Poles have succeeded in taking the Germans by surprise, but though they far outnumber the Nazis, Anders' army is still at a distinct disadvantage. The mountainside, after days of aerial bombardment, has been reduced to rubble, making the uphill climb extremely challenging. They can't see the enemy, and therefore they must reach the top of the monastery before having a chance at a clean shot. In the meantime, without a safe place to take cover, they are for the most part helplessly exposed. With his body still hugging the side of the mountain, Genick swears through his teeth. The army was supposed to be the safe choice, the way out of Siberia, the way to keep the family together. And it was for a while. Now, he's as safe as a bullseye in a shooting range, and his family some 4,700 kilometers away in Palestine. Genick can't help but think about how the Poles' first attempt on Monte Cassino, 5 days earlier, like the three before it, had been a gut-wrenching failure, met with mortar, small arms fire, and the devastating wrath of a 75-millimeter panzer gun. Anders' leading infantry divisions were all but wiped out after just a few hours of fighting. As quickly as the operation began, the Polish Second Corps was forced to retreat, reporting casualties of nearly 4,000 men. Genick and Otto had said thanks for the fact that they'd been assigned to an infantry division at the rear, and cursed the fact that despite the losses the enemy too had suffered, the monastery still lay in German hands. Thus far, the only uplifting piece of news they've received in the campaign has come from General Juin, leader of the French Expeditionary Corps, who reported that his men had taken Montemayo and were now in a position to assist the British 13th Corps stationed in the Liri Valley. It was still up to the Poles, however, to capture the monastery. They'd set forth on a second attempt that morning. More mortar. The crack of artillery overhead. The snare drum pop, pop, pop of flak meeting stone. Someone down the mountain screams. Genick stays low. He thinks of Hertha, of Yusef, contemplates finding a rock and hiding under it until the fighting stops. But then an image flashes through his mind. His family in the hands of the Nazis, forced into a death camp. His family, part of the purported millions, lost. A lump rises in his throat and his cheeks grow hot. He can't hide. He's here. If this mission is successful, he'll have helped to break the Germans and to remind the world that Poland, though defeated in Europe, is still a power to be reckoned with. Swallowing the metallic tang of fear at the back of his tongue, he realizes that, suicide mission or not, if there's a chance that he can help put an end to this wretched war, he sure as hell isn't giving up. Genick waits for a lull in artillery fire, and then scrambles a few meters up the mountain, keeping his body low and watching closely for mines and tripwires. In securing the stronghold, the Germans left a barrage of booby traps in their wake that had cost the lives of dozens of Genick's comrades. He's been trained to disable a mine, but he wonders if, under the circumstances, he'd have the wits about him to pull off the act should he stumble across an explosive in his path. Another thunderous boom, a monstrous explosion, somewhere to Genick's right. His body meets the mountain, nearly knocking the wind out of him. What in fuck's sake was that? His ears ring. There's been much talk among Anders' men about whether the enemy paratroopers in Cassino have access to the 28-centimeter K5 railway gun employed at Anzio. The Germans call the gun the Leopold. The Allies refer to it as Anzio Annie. Her shells weigh a quarter of a ton, with a range of over 130 kilometers.
There's no way they could have gotten that thing up the mountain, Genick reasons, trying to catch his breath.
If they had, he's pretty certain he'd have been blown to bits by now. The air is alive again with submachine gun fire. He lifts his chin, finds his breath, and scrambles another few meters up the mountain.
May 18, 1944. In their second attack on Monte Cassino, the Polish Second Corps meets constant artillery and mortar fire from the strongly fortified German positions above. With little natural cover for protection, the fighting is fierce and at times hand-to-hand. Thanks to the successful advance of the French Expeditionary Corps in the Liri Valley, however, German paratroopers withdraw from Cassino to a new defensive position on the Hitler line to the north. Early in the morning of May 18th, the Poles take the monastery. They are so battered, only a few have the strength to climb the last 100 meters. When they do, a Polish flag is raised over the ruins, and an anthem, the Red Poppies on Monte Cassino, is sung to celebrate the Polish victory. The road to Rome is open. June 6, 1944. D-Day. Codenamed Operation Overlord, the Battle of Normandy begins with a massive amphibious military assault, as some 156,000 Allied troops, led by General Eisenhower, storm a heavily fortified 50-mile stretch of the Normandy coastline. Low tide, poor weather, and an Allied deception plan allow the Allies to catch the Nazis by surprise.
Chapter 48. Jakob and Bella. Warsaw, German-occupied Poland, August 1, 1944. At the sound of the first explosion, Bella's blood whooshes from her head to her toes. Without thinking, she drops to all fours behind the checkout counter at the back of the dress shop. The detonation, close enough to rattle the coins in the cash register drawer, is followed by shouting and the rapid burst of gunshots. Bella crawls to the corner of the counter, peeks around it toward the glass storefront. Outside, three uniformed men run by, carrying Błyskawica submachine guns. Another bomb drops, and she covers her head instinctively with her hands. It's happening. The home army uprising. She has to get out. Fast. She crawls to the small room she's rented at the back of the shop, thinking frantically of what to bring. Her purse? Her hairbrush? No, not her brush, not important. Her keys, although she wonders if the building will still be standing in a day. At the last second, she lifts her mattress, retrieving two photographs, one of her parents, one of her and Anna as children, and slips them into the hem of her coat. She thinks about locking the shop's front door, but when four more uniformed men sprint by, she decides against it. Hurrying to the rear of the store, she exits quietly through the back door. Outside, the street is empty. She pauses to catch her breath. Jakob's words ring in her ears. "My building has a secure basement," he told her a week ago, when the uprising seemed imminent. "If there is fighting, meet me there." She'll need to cross the Vistula River to reach him. Bella sets off at a jog, headed northeast toward the bridge off of Wojtowska Boulevard, ducking into an alleyway when she hears the drone of approaching Luftwaffe aircraft. Pressing her body to the brick, she cranes her neck and counts 6 planes. They fly low like vultures. She wonders if she should wait it out, make a run for it once the skies have cleared, but decides she'd better not waste any time. She needs to be with Jakob. "You've walked this route dozens of times," she reasons. "It'll be 10 minutes on the road. Just get there." Bella picks up her pace, trying her best to keep one eye on the sky as she runs, but the uneven cobblestones make it difficult. Twice, she catches herself a millisecond before twisting an ankle, and finally decides she's safer watching her step and listening for planes, rather than stepping blindly, her chin cocked to the sky. She's made it 6 blocks when the growl of a Stuka returns. She ducks into another alleyway, just as a shadow darts overhead.
Please, God, no, she prays, squeezing her eyes shut, pressing up against the wall behind her, waiting. The growl fades. She opens her eyes and takes off again. Where is everyone?